You have a guest preacher who just made you say, thanks be to God, after the slaughter. You might be rethinking what you committed to this morning, but stick with me. Wanted to start off by saying thank you for the many ways in which this church has been a support in the work of Healing at the Wounding Place, Red Clover Initiatives, that for many years you have continued to pay attention to that work and to provide support. And I am very grateful. And it is always a gift for me when I get to be here with you. Though this is my first time preaching. I've gotten to share before, but to stand here in the robes, and I'm hoping I'm navigating that all well. New territory, a long way from the church in the park that I used to pastor, where there weren't pews. This morning, I want to bring you into this passage, and hopefully bring you to some new ways of seeing and hearing this story. Those who were in the adult Sunday school class this morning got to do a deep dive into that. If you didn't get to do that deep dive, all is not lost. Jeremy did refer to a book which does some of that deep dive in it, so I can encourage you to pick that up if your interest is piqued in where we go together this morning. But in my work of reconciliation with the church and Indigenous folks, we prayed this morning in the prayers of the people for the slowness of the calls to action. We're past 10 years since those were issued, and so few have really been realized, so few that are substantive. There has been progress, there has been movement, but is it lasting? Is it the kind of movement that will see change, that will be sustained? You know, the elders have said that it was 7 years of residential schools, that it will take the concerted effort towards healing and right relation for at least 7 years. Have we done the work of our generation to sustain and pass on that work for future generations? And we don't know. That is yet to be seen. But I experience a hunger in the church across Canada for how we might move more sustainably, more deeply towards that kind of right relationship. And I also encounter a lot of frustration and a lot of sense of, well, we've done some learning. We've learned how to do a land acknowledgement. But what is next? What is next? And I want us to spend some time in this parable because I think it's an example of some of the barriers that we actually encounter in the work of the next steps, the post-learning, continuing to walk in the learnings that we've received, movements towards deep and reparative change. That there is, in fact, I believe, a call on the church in Canada right now to return to our discipleship responsibilities of being people of repair. I'm going to throw you a fun fact this morning. Here's the fun fact. Did you know that it used to be in the Anglican Book of Common Prayers that as you prepared for communion, you would do a searching inventory of your heart for anywhere that you had caused harm and confess that. And then there was a line that dropped out of the Book of Common Prayer at about the time that colonial expansion started to happen. Coincidence? And that line was, may I consider the ways in which I might make reparations for the harms I've caused. This was central to every gathered time. This was central to the life of worship, that we consider how we might make reparations. But when was the last time that you heard the word reparations used in a way that you had responsibility for positively as a follower of Jesus in the church? So there's a sharp decline that begins to happen in the colonial period, the period of colonial expansion. Using that, it disappears by the second edition of the Book of Common Prayer. And there's a decision made south of the border. We're realizing that, unfortunately, we're maybe more tied to some of the things happening south of the border than we might like to be. But a decision was made south of the border at the end of the Civil War that really put the nail in the coffin of talk of reparations being a part of regular discipleship practice. And that conversation was about how the church in the U.S. was going to recover from the Civil War. How were they financially going to be able to recover? How were they going to deal with the fact that family members had fought on opposite sides in this war? How were they going to put the country back together? And a decision was made that we would focus no longer on how we might repair the relationships, but that we would move towards an embrace of forgiving and forgetting. You and I have inherited that decision in ways that have reached much farther than any of us might have imagined. But there's an opportunity for us to recover that core discipline, that core practice. And I think it's actually a longing for that that we experience in our conversations about healing and reconciliation. Because I think we are feeling like there are tools we don't have that we need. And I want to suggest that actually picking up this practice of repair is part of a call that I think the Spirit of God is stirring in us in churches across the country. Will we respond? Now, what on earth does that have to do with this parable about these 10 pounds? Well, to touch on it briefly, let's ask how it is that we maybe traditionally have heard and seen this parable. Someone this morning in the Sunday school class said that they've come to this parable in the past and wrestled with it, trying to make sense of it, and in the end gave up. Maybe that's been your experience as well. There's some harshness in here and some things that feel hard to reconcile. And so I want us to lean into that and to ask if there might be ways in which we've been reading the characters wrong. There's maybe another way to come at this parable that might make more sense. So let's visit what a traditional reading of this parable has been, and then we'll suggest an alternate reading that I think is actually closer to the first reading that those who heard the parable would have used in interpretation. So traditionally, we hear this story, and if you need to pull it up so that it's kind of fresh in your mind, feel free to do that. But when we ask kind of who's the hero, who's being lifted up in this story, and it seems like it is the person who has invested and turned the greatest profit, right? That is the person who the nobleman lifts up and praises to the greatest extent. And if that is, in fact, the exemplary behavior, the moral of this story, then the point of the story might be that Christians need to use their resources, the resources that have been given to us by God, to faithfully serve Christ. And if we do so, we will be rewarded with blessings abundant, right? That is traditionally how we have read this story, and I'm not arguing that those things aren't true, but that those things are not necessarily the point of this particular story, and that when we come at this story slightly differently, we start to see some new things. So let me invite a new perspective on what may be a new perspective for some of you on this text. And it is, so in the practice of biblical interpretation, there is an argument that you should take the simplest reading, and that might be the truest reading. Now, the problem is the simplest reading from a capitalist Western Canadian culture is very different from what the simplest reading would have been for the hearers of this parable. So if we can place ourselves in the context of this parable itself, if we can learn a couple of things about the history surrounding the situation, and if we can locate ourselves in context in the telling of this parable, I think some things begin to shift. So you'll notice that we read the first reading this morning was actually what precedes the parable of the, in my head it's the parable of the minas or the parable of the talents. Parable of the pounds is harder for me to get in my head, but the parable of the pounds. So we read the story of Zacchaeus first, and that is important because it is clear in the text, but we rarely read these texts together, that at the end of dinner in Zacchaeus' household, where Zacchaeus has had a significant change of heart, his encounter with Jesus has radically transformed him in ways that are going to sink his career as a tax collector because he is committed to making reparations financially to those he has cheated, and to also recognize that his participation in the system of Roman tax collection is oppressive to the poor, and that he therefore is going to pay half of what he has to the poor as well. So Zacchaeus has made this declaration, and then it says that Jesus then told this parable. So what changes if we see this parable, if we read this parable in the context of Zacchaeus' courtyard after this very significant event that has just happened? What changes as well if we start to see and realize that for the hearers of this story, there is some political news that is fresh in everyone's memories. That they are located in Jerusalem, they are located in Jericho, which was the site that was the stage for an invasion, an overthrow that was sanctioned by Rome. When Herod the Great died and Archelaus wanted to be crowned as the new ruler of this area, he went off to be crowned as such ruler. There was a contingent of 50 people who went and petitioned that he not be placed as ruler, when in fact he was established as ruler, and they all returned home. What happened to those 50 dissenters? They were punished for their actions, their disloyalty. So with this, very much in people's memories, we come again to this text and ask, who is the hero? What is the point of this story? That when we recognize that this location of Jericho, which is going to be emitting that recent transition of power, in this context of Zacchaeus' decision to not be a pawn of the oppressive system any longer, but to resist and to do something different, when we put this in the context of the appointment of Archelaus by Rome, what shifts? I think we can start to see that perhaps the hero in this reading that's closer to the time of those who heard it, that the hero in this story might actually be the one who buries his treasure and opts out. In fact, if we were to imagine ourselves as Zacchaeus listening to this parable being told, right? Zacchaeus, who's just had this encounter with Jesus that has resulted in life-altering decisions for him and by him, who then the teacher says, hey, everybody, gather around, I've got a story to tell. I wonder if Zacchaeus, listening to this story, is initially cheering for the ones who are making all that money, right? For the first two who doubled their money and get patted on the back and rewarded, and he's like, yeah, that's what we're doing. And then I wonder what happens for Zacchaeus as he's listening, and the third slave comes forward and says, "I got nothing for you. I just wrapped it up, buried it." And I wonder if the penny drops for Zacchaeus as he hears the nobleman's response to this third servant, this third slave. That what the nobleman says to him is, "You knew I was a hard master. Why didn't you at least charge interest?" Now for Zacchaeus, that should have been a key word. Where he's like, "Oh, wait. Now, I've been charging interest and more. That's how I've made my money, and I just swore off of that path. I just promised to rectify the harms that were perpetuated by those decisions. Hold on. I got to pay attention to a different hero in this story. If the one who buries his treasure and refuses to participate in the oppressive system, if he, in fact, is the hero in this story, then the moral of the story becomes something closer to, if we align with Jesus and his kingdom, then we will find liberation and life by the way of the cross. In fact, just after this story gets told, Jesus goes on ahead of the disciples and enters into Jerusalem, which will lead to the triumphal entry. These are his final days. This is the beginning of his journey to the cross. Here in this story that Zacchaeus is like, "Oh, I think my world is being turned on its head. I think Jesus might be telling my story," is also Jesus' story, saying, "You know what? I am not going to be appointed king. I am going to be killed by the kings of this world. I am going to resist that path of oppression, and that is the only way that my true kingdom can be ushered in." The church in Canada has aligned for a long time with the powers of this world, but I wonder if salvation might come to our house this day, as Jesus declares it comes into Zacchaeus' house, if we might consider more carefully, and with great cost. It does not escape me that this is not an easy path. It does not escape me that this actually is a path with great consequences. But I wonder if we, the church, are being called to follow Jesus on the path towards the cross, where we lay down our lives in love, in solidarity, risking what we have previously spent all of our time and all of our energy trying to protect and preserve, but have kept some from having enough, and too many have hoarded wealth and power and influence. Is the church being called to align differently, to resist the oppressive powers, maybe by burying the precious treasure, just as Jesus is buried, because life that is preserved with our own power is no life. But our lives that are offered and laid down have the potential for resurrection in the power of Jesus. Is this, friends, a call to us by the Spirit for new life to come in our midst as we walk a new path with greater risk and greater opportunity for the gospel to be realized? Thanks be to God. Amen.